jazz.
Busted.
All right. Well, yeah, it's an extravaganza. I apologize for the long list of things. I feel like for the 8th anniversary, did you even look up what the 8th anniversary is?
I thought you said it was wood, and I brought my own.
No, it's bronze or pottery. And Mike and I, as students of the 18th century, know those are the two most popular materials for condoms.
Oh, God.
Bronze or pottery. Yeah, it's podcast 208. It's our 8th anniversary. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike. So 26 times 8 is 208.
I think so. I mean, we've had more than that number of episodes because there's been a couple 0.5s.
But no, it's exactly right. My little back of the envelope math is that's exactly correct.
Well, good. Good.
Somewhere along the way, we did something right or wrong or I don't know, whatever.
So it's anyway. Happy New Year to our listeners. We are recording this before Christmas, but it will go live in January of 2021, which is going to go down in history as the worst year ever. I hope not. God, I hope not.
It can't.
Oh, we can get so much.
It can only be up from here, right? I mean, well, the good news is the Supreme Court didn't sell out, you know? So
yeah, it's just like, okay, we've got lifetime appointments. Fuck you, Trump.
We've got better things to do, like tell women what they can do with their bodies and, you know, rule in favor of corporations.
Absolutely.
We don't have time for your nonsense.
Which are people, but they can't ever right. go to jail. That's
they
the cool
can't go
thing.
To jail,
they've got
but
the
they
rights.
Get a vote.
But not the responsibilities of people. Right. And that's fair. Yeah. I think it's like, were the, you know, early years of the Great Depression really not worse than this? It sucks. I mean, I think I've personally been shielded from most of the effects of 2020. Both parents died. But, you know, other than that, I didn't lose my job, haven't caught COVID. My close friends haven't, you know. But I'm just convinced it's like, it really sucks, but I don't think this is the worst year ever, even for the United States, much less for humanity. But
yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb and say 1860 was just a little worse. But, you know, hey, if Texas decides to secede, we may get to experience all of those fun times all over again. I have to tell you, I feel sorry for you there in Indiana. You're going to be part of, I don't know what you'll be a part of. But us in California are taking our vegetables home, and you can go starve on corn and soybeans. That's what I say.
That's all you really need, that, and lots and lots of pork.
That's right. It's been a shitty year, that's for sure. It looks like next year could be marginally better. It could be marginally better. Supposedly they're shipping vaccines, and things are going to start to... They just can't get worse, right? I mean, it's good. People get to check the vaccine and find out that aliens land the next day. I mean, you know, things have got to start getting better. They can't get worse.
It's like
worse.
You want to anally probe me. Okay, that's actually a relief after last year.
That's right.
Probe away.
That's right. Does it come with a vaccination? I'm ready. I'm bending over now. I don't know.
Right.
It's crazy.
They're going to get COVID and die, just like in War of the Worlds. So... We have been for the last few years, and we'll see. We may give this up, but the format has been for our anniversary.
What? That's news. What?
We have, hold on, calm down, for the last few years on our anniversary, at Mike's suggestion, talked about ensembles comprised of people numbering the same as the number of our anniversary. So, we've done
septets. I thought you were saying something else. I thought you were saying... You were pulling a John Lennon. You were pulling the plug. You're out of here. Your history.
No, I'm absolutely not. No, but anyway, octets. It's the 8th anniversary octets. Though I made an exception for Paul Jackson's Black Octopus,
which has nothing to do with the theme. You suck.
It does because the title includes octopus, which is an 8-legged ink squirting.
You see, I'm so busy with grading and everything else in my life that. When you said that, I wasn't even paying attention. I was like, yeah, okay, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then I get to the album and I look at Purcell. I'm like, wait a minute. There's only 5 people on this album. What the hell?
Well, they're funky enough for 8. So that's the ringer just for fun. And, you know, I was thinking.
Some of us aren't busy.
I just got usual work. I got to admit, it's not, you know, we're kind of puttering along, but it's not crazy.
As enough of my students who are listening in the new year, the students of mine who are listening in the new year, the reason Daddy hasn't done your grading isn't the usual. He was too drunk
drinking.
To actually
Yes,
work.
Yeah, that's right,
because
Flint.
he was in an ICU recovering from Pat's injection of funk on top of everything else. So students, that's why your grades aren't done. It's all
most
Pat's
of all
fault.
The funk. Help
most
me
of all
find
the
funk.
Funk.
Flashlight, neon light. Yeah, so octets, you know, it's an interesting ensemble. I was trying to think of some of the famous octets of yore. You know, one that I think people overlook is Ornette Coleman's album Free Jazz. It's not an octet that we think of it. There's eight musicians, but they aren't arranged harmonically or anything, or even, what was his thing? It wasn't enharmonic. It was, what do you call it?
Alphabetic? Onomatopoeic?
No, he had some kind of harmonic. Harmonic. I knew it come to me.
And it didn't. It came to me.
Whatever. So I'm bringing
the feisty to this podcast. I just want you to know.
Great. Some big band leaders stripped down to octets when the big band era kind of crashed before they could rebuild, including Ellington and Basie. It was a favorite ensemble for the cool jazz period, most notably the Dave Pell Octet, people that were based on the Birth of the Cool Nonet, led by Miles Davis, Jerry Mulligan, et al. That's probably, we talked about one of those albums many, many moons ago by Dave Pell. It's not a brilliant ensemble, but it's a very pleasant ensemble. And I think like Shorty Rogers did an album based on that, or, you know, some of the West Coast groups that wanted a little big band sound use that octet format. We're going to talk about Ron Levitt. Ron Levitt made four albums back in the 60s, three on RCA and the one we're going to talk about on Riverside, and he led an octet. And again, it was for arrangement possibilities. And generally, if we're going to have that many musicians in a jazz group, but it's not a big band, you're doing it because you want to have more ambitious arrangements. You want to experiment with some harmonies or counterpoint, but you don't necessarily want the power or just the sheer grunt of a big band, or you might not have the budget for one. My favorite all-time octet is Dave Murray's octet. We've talked about at least one recording by that ensemble, and if you haven't heard them, Ming and Home are just two towering masterpieces in that format. Carla Bley did 4x4. I'm not that particularly fond of that particular album by her, even though I love Carla. And, you know, we talked about Stefan Harris's grand unification theory a few months or years or decades ago. I don't know what. And that was an octet. So those are kind of, I did a little poking around the internet. In this case, I picked out some octets because Mike was away from his main library. A couple of the new ones and a couple of ones that have been in the case, and he's very angry with me, but he normally is, because I slipped in an extra one.
And one of the four was a double disc.
Look, let it go. Alan Wakeman's The Octet Broadcast, 1969 and 1979, is a double disc that total runs like an hour. I got the CD version of it.
All I'm saying in class is this is what husbands who batter their wives say. It doesn't hurt that bad. You're not hurt. Get up.
Oh, God. Buck up, man. Yeah, to make more of an occasion of it, I guess, they packaged it this way. It's a very nicely put together package. So Alan Wakeman, a guy I never heard of, for a while we thought maybe he's Rick Wakeman. Maybe he was in Yes, we're not sure. He was not.
That was me being stupid. You knew always the correct.
He's a tenor saxophonist, as the people
British
introduced
like
the group. Yes. This came out on Gearbox this year, but their octet broadcast from England, Merry Old England, from 1969 and 79, that they're basically air checks that were packaged and let out to the world, I think on two LPs and two CDs, but the total running time of the whole shebang is about an hour. So I can understand why you might put that on two LPs. I have no idea why they put it on two CDs other than to make an occasion of it, because you could put another one of these sessions on there without running out of room. For a long time, I've had Gianluigi Trevosi's From G to G, a Soul Note recording. What a name. He's got a whole box on Soul Note. I want to get this now.
Yeah.
1996 recording. He's got a group there that I think is well, we'll talk about its antecedents and its influences and what we thought of it. But that was one that was just kind of in the cooker for a long time. I also, for a long time, had Ron Levitt's Dynamic Sound Patterns on Riverside from 1963. And Levitt led an octet, and we'll talk about those influences when we get to it. And made four recordings. I've not heard the other three. All were on RCA. And he's a pretty much in obscurity. It makes George Russell look like a celebrity. But he led some recordings of fairly arranged music in that era. And then Paul Dunbar Octet, Cuneiform Records has gotten my email somehow, and they send me weekly emails saying this particular album is on sale for $5. And it popped up as an octet, and I said, my God, well, this is God speaking to me through the internet. I should give this a listen. And it's kind of probably our most the British one is pretty avant-garde. It's an album called Bebop Starburst on Cuneiform Records from 1999. And then as the spoiler, as the odd entry, a Japan-only album originally on Eastworld from 1978, Paul Jackson, the bass player and the Headhunters organization with Herbie Hancock, released a record called Black Octopus. Not an octet, but look how many arms does an octopus have? Yeah, that was inexcusable. So, do you have a preference as to how we go this torture that I've subjected you to? Do you care?
Oh, now he asks me which bludgeon I'd like to be hit with first.
That's right. Choose your poison.
I don't care. You pick. It's fine. Anything, wherever you want to go is fine.
He's been beaten down so much. The cycle of abuse continues. I'm thinking, let's just go chronologically. So maybe start with Rod Levitt. He's a trombone player, arranger, and conductor. He has an octet, Rolf Erickson on trumpet, Buzz Wren on soprano, saxophone, clarinet, George Marge, tenor sax, clarinet, piccolo, Gene Allen, baritone, saxophone, clarinet, Cy Johnson, piano, John Beal, bass, and Ronnie Bedford on drums. So an octet, probably our most traditional selection of the group there. Did you like this dynamic sound patterns at all, or did you find them static? What do you think of this one?
I think it's interesting. George Marge also plays English horn, and I can't get enough English horn and oboe and jazz ever, so that's kind of cool. I have a piece of trivia about this that you may not know. I'm very excited to tell you a fact you do not know. Did you know that Downbeat in 1964, for those the kids out there don't know, Downbeat, the jazz magazine that used to do they still do this, Patrick? Blindfold tests?
You know, I have not read them for a while. I think I've never seen an issue that does not have them. So right. I'm assuming so.
So in 1964, Downbeat had a blindfold listening test. So they take some, you know, person eminent in the music, and they play stuff that might be obliquely of interest to that person without telling them what it is. Sometimes the very well listened or just well read among the people who take the blindfold test can actually identify who, you know, the recording and the leader and all of that stuff. Other times the people that give the blindfold test cannot. And Miles Davis was always a favorite on the blindfold test because Miles Davis
routinely didn't censor himself. Yeah.
He didn't censor himself, and he routinely said things like, you know, that guy sounds white, I don't like it. Or that guy sounds black, a million stars, or whatever. He kind of was routinely rude and obnoxious in the blindfold test. And this album, this very, very album, Rod Levitt's The Dynamic Sound Patterns of the Rod Levitt Orchestra, was played for Miles Davis.
Oh, boy.
In the 1964 Downbeat, in which he said he hated everything except the bass player.
I am not shocked at all.
The reason I bring this up is you can see why the naive editors of Downbeat might want to play this for Miles Davis, right? It has some cool school leanings, you know? I mean, it's the kind of thing that that Miles did with Gil Evans, right?
Right.
It has whispers of Quiet Nights, not so much, but I mean, Sketches of Spain, right? And even some, not even that, but even some of the earlier stuff, right? It has Cool School echoes. So I'm sure the Downbeat editors were thinking, hey, this might be interesting. Miles might groove to this. And apparently he was, you know, fairly dismissive and just said he didn't like anything except the bass player. Okay.
His Caucasian detector was like on high alert. Dweet.
To Miles' credit, the bass player on this is awfully good. He's very fine. But yeah, that's, I thought you'd be amused by that anecdote. Yeah, I did kind of like this. I thought it was pretty cool. I thought it was a weird. I thought you mentioned when we were talking about this that, you know, reminded you of a little bit of George Russell. I really did hear some Gil Evans arrangement sounds here. I don't know if that was intentional on Rod Levitt's part or if that's just, you know, he arrived at those sounds on his own. But it sounded sometimes like a cross for me between Evans and Russell.
He's got that busyness. There's a little bit more counterpoint. I mean, it's not that Evans never does that, but Evans is also more committed to the float and just sheer atmosphere. And there's not none of that here, but it's you know, there's that Russell, one, the kind of more openly dissonant voicings. I mean, Evans does that, but he tends to bury them a little bit more. And well, just and the kind of surge, yeah, the kind of, you know.
I was fluid by at least one personnel in common, Rolf Erickson, who appears on some Gil Evans stuff, the trumpet player here. So I thought that was interesting. The first thing I wanted to say about Rod Levitt is, you know, he's an arranger and he's the trombonist, and he plays a very pretty trombone, but he does not forward himself too often in this. It's much more it's much more about the other members of the ensemble. The most Gil Evans cut for me was the one called Ah Spain. I really was like, golly, how do you not hear that there? It seems like the reed players he has here all double on clarinet. So Buzz Wren plays alto in clarinet. George March plays everything in clarinet. Gene Allen plays Barry in clarinet. And he sure loves him some clarinet, Rod Levitt does. It seems like not only is there clarinet on every song, but in some cases it's, you know, they are the wind section. You know, he's got them all playing together in unison. I kind of like this. I thought it was pretty good. It was enjoyable. I could have done with a little bit more from both the tenor and the Barry. I like both of their solos when they solo, especially the Barry player, and he doesn't get to take very many things very far out. The last songs felt, well, the weirdest one here is something called, what is it, hot, his master's voice. It's got this sort of sprightly ensemble open and a weird slow middle and then a pickup in the middle again with solos over the ensembles. It was kind of trippy. It felt like a kind of sweet. And that, too, reminded me of Evans. Some of these songs were arranged in kind of large tripartite structures. The length of these things isn't that long. His master's voice is 8 minutes. Upper bay is, you know, 9 minutes. Holler, the opener, is 9 minutes. Everything else is about 5 minutes, you know. So, yeah, I kind of dug this. I thought Holler was kind of a bebop inflected burner, but not quite bebop, right? But it was, it had this he has this sort of bebop structure through all of these where everyone kind of get, not everyone, but there are featured solos in between structured ensemble work or over ensemble work. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't out in that sense. It was, you know, pretty traditional, I thought, the structures of this all together. I liked Jellyman because of the English horn solo to open the song. It's really sinuous. And that's a real traditional, you know, the English horn solos at the open. Then we get kind of an ensemble playing the main figures. Then we get, you know, a clarinet solo. Then we get a trombone solo. Then we get reeds. Then we get the English horn soloing. You know, everyone kind of takes the tune out for a spin for a while. So in terms of like structure, this feels the most traditional maybe of everything we're listening to, but the instrumentation is just dead fascinating to me. Because like I said, he seems to feature the clarinets over the other reeds, even though everyone, you know, is doubling on something else. And that gave some of the songs a kind of astringent quality that I found kind of interesting. Yeah, but all in all, I thought this was pretty compelling ear-wise. I don't like the title. I don't get the title, the dynamic sound patterns. It sounds like a sound check, you know? It's like, this is a dude who's listened to some stuff, and he's got some ideas that are not that far from some interesting things that other people are doing in the music. And I don't think it has anything to do with dynamic sound patterns. I kind of half kept expecting it to, I'd have to turn it up and turn it down or something. I don't know. And it wasn't like that. It was just, you know, this kind of octet doing fairly traditional. When I say traditional, what I mean by that is the structure that, you know, there's sort of ensemble playing with open spots for solos. And the melodies are identifiable. They're repeatable.
Right.
Sort of by something like a traditional structure here. So it's kind of in, but it's not strictly bebop. It doesn't have quite that feel. Like I said, I felt it was somewhere across between Evans and Russell. So I liked it. I thought it was interesting, and I'd like to hear more of this guy's work. He had apparently a kind of sad life. I guess he passed away, but he had Alzheimer's at the end, which, you know, that would suck if you're a musician, I would think. Well, it would suck for anyone, but I mean, as a musician, so much of, you know, what you do is based in memory and you know, soundscapes that you can call up at will, and that would be frustrating to have that fade away. So, yeah, he's worth digging into deeper, I think, just on the basis of this outing. I kind of liked it, and this is definitely for people who are into the not the 70s Evans, not when he gets electronic, but, you know, the earlier, the cool school Evans. You know, if you dig that, you'll probably like this, I would think. You like it, I take it.
I did, yeah. I think that what he does not have is quite a charismatic soloist on the level, obviously, of a Miles Davis, but even some of the other guest stars that Evans had, like a Cannonball Adderley or whoever. And, you know, I am also reminded of, we've talked before about George Russell's sextet or septet recordings that I think are really gems of the catalog on Riverside from this era, but were never particularly popular. And, you know, and it's really, this is a kind of ensemble where if you're a ambitious writer and you're trying to do new things and you aren't necessarily all that focused on finding a popular audience, this is a kind of ensemble that makes sense for you, right? 6 to 8 people, you can get some harmonies in there, you can get some counterpoint if you want. You can have fairly intricate writing, but it's not about the sheer rock and roll power of a big band. And I talk many times, as I think, you know, Benny Goodman Live or whatever, you know, Buddy Rich showed this in his stuff. I dubbed a couple of his stuff on Pacific, a couple of his albums on Pacific. You know, the big band really is kind of the predecessor in some ways of the rock group in that it's about kind of visceral impact. It was youth music of its time. And this is kind of artsier than that. It grew on me over time. I think it's certainly of these selections, you understand why 8 people are there. Whereas I think as you get more avant-garde, it's nothing wrong with it. It can be done. It's just, you know, it seems a little bit more arbitrary as opposed to your goals. You could have 3 people doing avant-garde music or 10, and the difference is going to be to some degree volume and number of solos rather than a sense that the ensemble as ensemble is doing something notable that it couldn't do at a smaller level. So yeah, he's definitely a writer. You know, he's interested in the writing. That's the focus of this. And for me, the most relaxed track for some reason was El General. It's not the most innovative. It's not, you know, but just where I felt like they really hit a groove there. And I was really kind of, you know, nodding my head along. But yeah, this is one I had in the collection for a while. And I don't know, it was kind of built up in the where I read about it as something that it didn't strike me as upon first listening. But then coming back to it, I felt like, well, this is kind of, I mean, to me, I'd say George Russell before Evans, but they're both definitely influences. And that, you know, there's that kind of intricacy and the drive to it. And it seems closer to bebop than Evans, but it's still a little bit angular, a little bit astringent. The harmonies are a little bit, you know, more openly, not atonal, but kind of clashing or dissonant than you get in much bebop. And it is definitely, yeah, there's something to do with cool in here, but it's not, the drift is largely absent, you know, the kind of the clouds of sound that Evans was famous for in Thornhill and then brought to the Birth of the Cool project and to some degree, most notably in Sketches of Spain or Summertime on Porgy and Bess, you know, that kind of sense of a float to it. I don't think Rod's much of a floater. But yeah, on the basis of this, I'm kind of curious to hear his RCA stuff. All of it is very obscure. You know, he is a rank behind Russell, much less Evans, who, of course, got a higher profile from dealing with Miles, so... You know, just an oddity, but an enjoyable one. I think as music, it works pretty well.
Okay. Cool.
Now, moving right along, chronologically, I guess the next releases would be the Alan Wakeman broadcasts. This is an artist I never heard of before. Alan is a tenor saxophonist. He also plays clarinet. Not really, these recordings are not focused on his own soloing, more his writing, though he does solo a little bit. Alan Skidmore is present on tenor saxophone and flute on the first session, so the 1969 session. We also have Mike Osborne on alto and clarinet, Paul Rutherford trombone, Paul Neiman, trombone, John Taylor, piano, Lindsey Cooper, bass, Paul Litton, drums. And then on the second disc, 10 years later, the first disc is just three performances that don't have a unifying theme that often get fairly out. The second performance excerpts from a long two-hour piece he did about chess. And there is both of these have the announcer's full spiel in them. And oddly, they're not put on their own separate tracks, which I just think is a bizarre choice. But the second one is like five movements shortened down from this long piece he did about chess. He reappears on Reed's, Alan Skidmore's tenor and soprano saxophone, Art Thaman on tenor and soprano saxophones, Henry Lothar on trumpet, Paul Rutherford again on trombone, Gordon Beck piano, Chris Lawrence bass, Nigel Morris on drums. And we've talked in the last few years with the help of some of our listeners pointing us in the right direction about the great flowering of jazz in London in the last 10 or 15 years. But, you know, at least one review's pointed out, it's like obviously there's been a thriving English jazz tradition for many decades, and Wakeman was one avatar of that. So a couple of shots from the radio that were released by Gearbox this year, but date back to 69 and 79, a double album, but the whole running time is about an hour. What do you make of these octets?
First of all, I got to say something about the announcer.
And now, Jazz Workshop. My name is Brian Priestley, and the music is by Alan Wakeman.
I mean, what was your reaction to the announcer? Can we just bitch about the announcer for a minute?
Well, they're two, right? I think it's different guys.
I think it's the same guy. Isn't maybe, it the same guy?
I don't know.
It's Charles Fox.
No, it's I feel like one of them is a British writer I've heard of.
No.
Who's written about jazz. Yeah, no. Anyway, they're both very, very, very English. And they kind of, again, the presentation of all this, I don't know why it was on two compact discs. I don't know why they didn't make the announcement separate tracks, because most of us, when we're listening to music, love the context once or twice of the spoken word stuff, but then tend to skip it. So Gearbox made some interesting choices here. Other than that, I don't know. They love to say saxophonist, which I just think is hilarious, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's I'm almost certain it's, you know, my data here says it's Charles Fox on both. And,
okay.
And I want to punch him in the head. I only want to punch him in the head because every time he comes up, I just want to get back to the music. Not that he says anything wrong or anything like that. It's worth pointing out that the figures here are at least some of the ones you mentioned, are figures of the British avant-garde. So Paul Rutherford has a long, storied career as part of the British avant-garde. I mean, there is a British avant-garde, and he's part of it. And Wakeman is a new name for me. I didn't realize that. But obviously he's, you know, Evan Parker is a name that's name-checked in the introductions as someone who's been in this group and then, you know, had to be away for one of the Chaturanga performance. And so, you know, someone stepped in for him. Evan Parker, we've talked about, I don't think we've ever listened to anything and talked about him on the podcast, but we both have strong opinions about him.
You know him pretty well, right? I mean, I feel like you've got a lot of Evan Parker.
I have more than enough Evan Parker to last me a lifetime. He's a very shrill out player and does some really challenging oblique stuff that will give you a nosebleed or a migraine. And I think that's a useful place to start because, you know, Wakeman is hip enough and out enough to attract a talent. And it must be said, Evan Parker is a talent to attract a talent like Evan Parker to play in his ensemble. And yet this is way more accessible than that stuff. Like, you know, this is out, but it doesn't hurt. The Chaturanga stuff. So he has this. Stuff is this, you know, piece about chess. And what's kind of fascinating about it, and this is why the Charles Fox introduction is valuable, is he kind of explains the theory behind the piece. So when you hear the theory, you're like, Alan Wakeman is actually thinking about race. All the stuff about, you know, white faints while black takes the center. This is race code stuff, I'm convinced. I mean, I think Wakeman's doing something rather clever. So the names of the pieces, the names of the suite or the parts of the Chaturanga suite are named for chess openings or chess maneuvers like the kingside breakthrough or the Robotch defense. The Manhattan Variation. These are names for chess maneuvers. That's what's going on, right? And Charles Fox's introduction makes it clear that Wakeman has kind of thought this through. And I cannot accept that this is random. You know, he talks about, you know, the kingside breakthrough is blah, blah, blah. You know, white's pieces fail to hold the center. Chaos ensues, you know. And I think there's like race reflection on here. I mean, I think this is deliberate on Wakeman's part. And that I kind of thought that was interesting and clever, and I liked it. I also happen to like that music. It sounded like the quieter parts of Love Supreme. That's what a lot of this reminded me of, the Chaturanga stuff. It has that kind of meditative, spacey, spiritual, earnest, not po-faced, but just sort of earnest quality. In fact, if there's a kind of a running theme today through everything, it's that everyone's pretty serious, with the exception of Paul Jackson. Everyone's pretty... everyone's pretty serious about their work, you know, and Wakeman's pretty serious about all of this stuff. I don't want to make it sound like everything on the Chaturanga half of the broadcast is, some of it's just kind of straight up late bebop ensemble writing. It's not all spacey and spiritual, but the other broadcast, I don't know if that's 69 or 79, Dreams, Forever,
right,
Mary, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. So the Chaturanga is the 79, which is much more tonal.
Yes.
And then the 69 one is more out. Just out. Yeah.
Yes. And it has enough touchstones that you can follow along. Like, it's not completely out, but it's pretty far out. And I like that stuff. I find that infinitely listenable. It doesn't have recognizable melodies. Like, you're not going to follow it for melodies. You're following it for the blowing. And there's some really good blowing on it. Wakeman can play. But I found myself drawn more to the 79 stuff only because I thought it was kind of thoughtful. And I thought there was like a kind of a mystery there to be unpacked regarding the material on race. And maybe I'm just deeply mistaken, but I can't help but hear those overtones when I listen to it. So I'm kind of curious if that was intentional on Wakeman's part or if he just likes chess. You know, it has nothing to do with, you know, white and black. But for a man who is playing, especially in the 69 broadcast, music that sounds real Coltrane-esque, thinking about white and black seems kind of intentional to me. I don't feel like it's accidental. So I'm kind of curious about how that works. But yeah, I thought the stuff on the first, you know, the 69 outing would not come out of place on a Pharoah Sanders disc from the early 70s or, you know, very late edition Coltrane when he was playing in larger ensembles, you know, Africa Brass Sessions, stuff like that. It reminded me of that a lot. And it was familiar and comfortable. I liked it. I thought it was good. I didn't think it was supremely original, the 69 stuff. You know, I was like, okay, other people are doing this, but I like that he's doing it and he's doing it pretty well. So if you like the out stuff of certain players, you know, sort of tenor-led ensembles before fusion, if you like the more outplaying of those guys, you'll dig this. You know, you'll find it in your wheelhouse. If you hate that stuff, if late Coltrane makes your teeth bleed, don't pick this up because you'll be really unhappy. Or if you do, just listen to the second CD. Don't listen to the first one.
Yeah, right.
Did you like it?
Well, yeah. I think that to some degree, even this one, and it had, I think, more memorable tunes than Bebop Starburst, but it's part of what I'm struggling with is just with an octet is like, do you have memorable material? I think that the playing is fine, and I quite liked some of it, but it is a sense of, okay, but I'm having trouble knowing that I want to hear so-and-so, such-and-such section again or whatever. You know, it's just kind of, it wasn't very distinctive for me melodically or structurally. So while I liked it, and I certainly liked it, I think the chess stuff was a lot more, I don't know if accessible is right, but just it seemed to have more fiber to it. There is that expectation for me, at least, that when you're doing an octet, that a lot of it's about, you know, that you have something to say compositionally. Because if you're just getting guys together to blow, really that size is a bit unwieldy. It's a group size to me for the most part, and there are exceptions. You know, I was wondering, was Ascension also an octet? But I think it was bigger than that even, you know, where it's largely about energy and a series of solos. But if you don't have the best players on the planet, you know, you probably want to have interesting writing. And there were sections, you know, one thing that kind of struck me is like the last piece on the 69 session is kind of like it's not Circus Tent. What's the name of it? It's something.
Merry-go-round.
Thank you. And, you know, it starts with this very out Pharoah Sanders' blowout, and then the material comes up. I was just thinking, you know, it's just an interesting way to present it. To me, it's like, give me some kind of frame, give me the merry-go-round, and then go crazy off of it. Don't start with the crazy and then bring the circus in later. I just, in terms of a way of orienting myself musically, and maybe that's my conservatism, you know, stepping up, I would have preferred something to deconstruct before just starting with deconstruction or chaos and then moving towards structure. But, you know, it's not like that's breaking a law or something. In general, as I said, I think that the later session was probably a little bit more accessible. And it is very much, these aren't concerts. They aren't complete performances. It's more BBC One had a segment available, I'm guessing a 30-minute segment. And they featured this particular ensemble that apparently never recorded in the studio. And then 10 years later, they featured, you know, a new version of it with the same composer and some of the same musicians. So it's this odd thing. It's not quite a full statement, but it's not just a song or something. It's just, you know, 30 minutes of stuff. It taught me a lot, and then I'd never heard of Alan Wakeman and some of these other musicians. I vaguely knew the names, but it gives you a sense of what was going on in England, which has always been kind of a distinctive scene and has always had there's Moldy Figs there aplenty, and there are some more or less straight beboppers and whatnot, but they've always also had a pretty strong avant-garde contingent. And then I feel like, you know, recently it's been kind of bringing in ethnic strains, and I think largely the stuff I've heard, not exclusively, but a lot of it, you know, is more tonal, is more kind of got more of a folk strain to it, more trying to appeal to a larger audience, where this clearly is just as artsy as it could be. So, yeah, interesting package. And again, you know, when this runs across, like, oh, this octet, okay, well, that seems like God speaking to me. There's certainly some octets, you know, I think both of us could have drug off the shelves that we love to death, but I felt like we gave David Murray a fair shake. And yeah, if you haven't heard David Murray's Homer Ming, run out and get those stat. I like them better than anything on this show. But, you know, I thought it was worth trying to look at new stuff.
Cool.
So the next performance, and let's see, I think, yeah, so from G to G, Gianluigi, I mean, I've heard of Luigi, I know about Luigi from Mario, and I've heard of Giano and Giordano's, but Gianluigi is beyond my pronunciation capabilities. We actually had a writer come in who was very upset that we did not pronounce some Chicago musician's names properly, and I basically said, well, we both have full-time jobs, we're doing this for free, we're doing our best.
You didn't tell me this. Who did we mispronounce? Who did they get mad at?
I don't know. He's like, they're well-known musicians. I'm like, well, I don't want to go into it with the guy. I felt like, okay, I'm glad you're being protective of your turf. Actually, both of us have spent time in Chicago. Mike grew up there. But it's like, God, there are no well-known musicians in jazz. And there may be 15 names or 20 names known to most people who go to jazz festivals. And these musicians are fine human beings, but they are not among those names. I mean, let's you know, we've got to be realistic about not the worth of this art, which is immeasurable, but the public profile of it. And even among aficionados, we can't keep track of all these names. We don't know them. So it was just
it reminds me of our never-ending quest to straighten out whether it's Dave or David Liebman, because I've seen both on releases.
So yeah, whatever he wants. I
think it's mostly Dave,
that.
You know, but yeah. Unless you've been to a festival and heard someone on stage live pronounce the name who you think you can trust, sometimes it's hard. But I would say you're pretty close here with Gianluigi Trovesi. I think that's pretty close.
And, you know, even if you YouTube these guys, you might well get a few performances, but those performances won't necessarily contain them or someone else speaking their name. You know, anyway, and again, I got to say, we don't get lots of emails. We appreciate all of them. And 95% of them are extraordinarily kind. So I'm not, you know, complaining. I just, you know, I'm like, well, okay, I'm sorry, dude. We're doing our best. We, at least we know that we're not being right. But yes, I guess we should be better and try to be right. Especially me, you know, God knows I've got a problem. Anyway, this guy has been in my collection forever, and he's an Italian jazz musician. I do not know, recognize the names of the guys in his group. He's on reeds. And as I look at these names, they're all fine musicians. I don't want to attempt to pronounce them because I know I'm getting them wrong.
I'm ready to take a shot.
You jump in the fire, my friend.
All right. So we have, oh no, I can't read my own handwriting. All right. On trumpet and flugelhorn, we have Pino Menafra. I believe I've got that one right. Rodolfo Migliardi, Bigliardi. On trombone and tuba, love the tuba. Roberto, I can't read my handwriting. I think it's Bonatti. It might be Bonatti if I've screwed up.
I think it's Bonatti for my typing.
On bass. Also on bass, Marco Mitchell. That's a pronounceable name. Then on cello, Marco Remondini. And then Fulvio Moras on percussion. And Vittorio Marino on drums. And then John Luigi plays reeds, alto clarinet and bass clarinet.
Yeah, there's some good low energy here. It's an interesting setup in that there are three winds and cello and no piano, and then drums and two bassists to make up this octet. I mean, I was kind of saying, well, are there eight people here? I mean, he calls it an octet. Of course, Henry Threadgill famously called his seven-person group a sextet, so you never quite know. So it's a little bit different than you might expect. This one I felt like was all over the map, but finally probably a little bit more about arrangement and harmonizing than the Wakeman group, or to some degree, we're going to talk about after the break, the Denmal Octet's Bebop Starburst. This one, it was interesting. I mean, I got into it after a while. I not listened to it extensively when I first picked it up, probably from E-Music, and now I feel like I should go out and get the, he did like eight or nine albums on Solnum. I mean, he was prolific for them. Of course, an Italian-based label that recorded both Italians and an American artist. So did you like from G to G?
Yeah, and I do think of the things we looked at this week, it has the most sonic variety. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
No, that's fair, yeah.
I think it's not just one thing. I kind of want to know the story behind the H.E.R. stuff. So the names of the cuts on this album, we don't always do this, but it opens with a song called Herbalk, H-E-R-B-A-L-K. And then there's Herbop Part 1 and Herbop Part 2. Now I Can. The fifth cut is called From G to G. The sixth cut, I assume this is the Italian word for Daedalus, Daedalo. And then the final cut is called Hercab. So I just, you know, this is one of those cases where I kind of wish I had liner notes, because what is the her stuff about? I don't get it. I don't, you know, maybe there's that there's some Italian there that makes sense. I don't know. I'm just ignorant, so I'm just curious about that. Also, we sometimes talk about lovely covers. This has not got a lovely cover.
No.
I don't like the picture on this album. The less said about it, the better.
It's all very gold. Yes, it's all
yes. Gold. And maybe it reminds me too much of myself, an aging white man with an unkempt beard and straggly hair. I don't know. It's not a good look for anyone. Anyway, yeah, I thought this was the weirdest in some ways of the releases in terms of the stuff they get up to. I think you can encapsulate the strangeness of it by talking about the opener, Herbalk, which is only about 4 minutes, a little under 4 minutes, which is just, you know, light percussion and then some arco bass and then both basses and then bass clarinet kind of over that. And it's both, if it can be described thusly, it is both puckish and mellow at the same time. and then we talk about her about part one, which sounds like, you know, when I listen to it, I'm like, okay, I sort of know what this is. And then there's her about part two. Which is fucking weird, and coming from, you know, someone who loves him some Sun Ra, that's saying something. How would you describe Herbot Part 2? It's got a lot of spacey sound effects with, like, the trumpet and the alto riffing over treated various percussion. It's just a strange... It's just strange. A lot of it sounds like it was recorded with the echo turned up to, as Stan Freberg would put it, 11, you know.
Yeah.
Too much echo. I mean, it's really weird. And then it has this sedate middle portion, which is like from another song altogether. And then if memory serves, it kind of returns to the weird spacey stuff with, you know, like, pizzicato cello and scattered percussion and ensemble bursts over that. It's definitely I'm not going to say earworm, because it's not like I have this song memorized, but when it comes up, it doesn't sound like anything else this week. You know, Herbot Part 2 is just damn strange. It's a very odd little cut. And that's kind of the mode on most of this. I said that everyone is pretty serious this week, and I guess I need to revise that, because I do think that Trevesi is puckish. The final cut, yeah. Her Cab, is, I don't know what the fuck that is. That's the one with tuba, and it sounds like the out music for a screwball comedy. It's this weird, you know, with this sort of trippy, sprightly, goofball theme played over, you know, the sort of basic 2/4 tuba figure. It's just, the whole thing is fun and weird and odd. But that's not the tone of the whole album. I mean, the puckish stuff is here, but part one, Herbop, is not puckish. That's pretty serious. The same with From G to G, the longest cut here, which is pretty challenging, I think. So, you know, these guys are odd. I don't quite know what to make of this, apart from the fact that it's fairly consistently surprising. It doesn't fall into any easy pattern. And I also think, unlike some of the other octets, this is through composed, but it's not the whole ensemble playing at all times. There's lots of people dropping out for various people to take the forefront. So sometimes it feels like only three or four members of the ensemble are playing. And oftentimes it'll be some of that busy rhythm for someone to solo over. So it's just it's kind of a breath of fresh air, and it's kind of weird, and it's kind of hard to characterize. You know, when I listened to this, especially that last song, Her Cab, it reminded me of Enrico Rava, some of the late Enrico Rava stuff. I think we did one for a podcast, one of his live discs. Remember the disc where Enrico Rava plays the Michael Jackson songs?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It reminded me of that. There were times where I was like, this sounds... I mean, this is not... These are all originals, presumably. But it had that kind of... I don't know. I'm having a hard time characterizing this.
I mean, it's a unusually broad European humor.
Yeah.
That I think is a little bit, as you said, all the rest of these productions are fairly serious. And it's not that this is never serious, but, you know, there's this weird mumbling talking along. It's like, what the hell is going on? Some of the jauntier music reminds me of, you know, Mingus to some degree, right?
There's yeah,
a couple songs which has got that little, you know, Fables of Fabius or whatever, where he's kind of mocking the racist governor.
Mm-hmm.
So there are examples of this kind of thing, this broad humor, this kind of wildness, but it is, it's, and of course, at the same time, there's some pretty intricate writing and just odd atmospheric things that are hard to place. But the other touchstone for me is that this is sometimes reminiscent, sometimes fairly closely, of Henry Threadgill's so-called sextet, my favorite of his ensembles, that of course had seven players in it, did have a cello player as well. And of course, Henry has an odd sense of humor. It is drier, whereas this sometimes gets pretty broad. But, you know, there's that, he's, and of course, some of his stuff, his humor is just purely in the titles or, but you know, there's some touchstone there. I mean, I feel like this guy's listened to some Threadgill, probably more than David Murray, and definitely some Mingus, and is kind of bringing that sensibility of it's okay to be funny sometimes, it's okay to be odd and spacey. But I'd say that, you know, to me, it's probably the most interesting and successful of the recordings we're looking at, though I think if you really feel like music that is humorous bothers you, you don't like it when it sounds like people aren't being entirely serious, you might want to give this a wide berth, because some of it is, I mean, it doesn't bother me, but it's, you know, there's some sense of just kind of a very odd, almost surrealist humor. And I tend to think, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, some European artists are just more known for that. And even our own Carla Bley, who's very American, there's something about, you know, she's got a kind of a quasi-European sensibility about her, that she's one of the great humorists in jazz. And again, I'm not saying it's invalid or that it's lesser than quote-unquote American jazz or whatever, or the British jazz, which in this case, the Wakeman stuff is, as you say, fairly serious. I mean, there's a satire, I guess, in a couple of the pieces, but still overall, it's kind of, you know, this is art music kind of stuff. So yeah, I liked it quite a bit. I mean, it's one of those things that had been hovering in my collection. It's written up pretty positively a couple places, and I think it's probably why I downloaded it in the first place, and then I didn't quite necessarily get what they're going for. I think it's varied enough that you have to kind of turn it up to focus on it, you know, because it doesn't get in a predictable groove, so you kind of know where it's going and you can follow along. You have to kind of to crank it and focus. And I don't know that I've got, I mean, I think they're all good players, but I don't know that any one of them has struck me positively or negatively, just in terms of, oh, this guy's an outstanding soloist I want to hear more of. I think I'd have to listen to more of the group's recordings or listen to this one a lot more before I started putting characteristics on the players per se, other than, again, a willingness to kind of go broad. But, you know, as an octet, as a named octet, I mean, it's called, you know, his octet. And I think it's a group that apparently, I mean, he's got 9 records on Soul Note Black Saint. So I have to decide if I'm going to pull the trigger on that after spending just infinite amounts of money in December on music. Probably I won't, but maybe someday I'll track that down. But it's fascinating, and it's not, I guess I'd say, you know, if I listen to Rod Levitt, who I like quite a bit, there are touchstones. You said Gil Evans and George Russell. I mean, it's a certain era, and some of the references he's pulling on are pretty audible to people that listen to that era of jazz. This is a little different enough that it's a little harder to place. It's like, what exactly is going on here? What's this guy up to? What's his name? Is it Luigi? Is it what's going on, dude? So many parts. I'm sure it's probably like the equivalent of like Joe or Fred in Italy, but it just seems a little trickier. Okay, the last jazz octet we're going to talk about is by Paul Dunmall. Never heard of the guy. He released Bebop Starburst on Cuneiform Records in 1999. I think he's also an English artist, and he's a tenor saxophonist. And Simon Picard is also on tenor sax, Annie Whitehead on trombone, Chris Bridges on trombone. Gethin Liddington, trumpet. Keith Tippett is a name I've certainly heard many times in English context on piano. Paul Rogers, bass. And Tony Levin, drums. Wasn't there like a Levin who was in King Crimson who played stick?
Yes, different Tony Levin. There's the Tony American Levin who plays bass and stick, and then there's the British Tony Levin who plays drums.
That is confusing as heck. So this was one that was just came through my inbox as an advertisement, and I thought, well, it's an octet, it's jazz, I should download this. So we've got some new stuff to talk about, and I'm not ranting on about how great David Murray's early octet albums were. Also kind of avant-garde, even though, you know, he says Bebop Starburst, and there are little moments of bebop, but some of it's pretty out. Did you like Bebop Starburst? Is it your favorite kind of Starburst? Or
I did like it. Evan Parker was the producer on this, so that also helps give you some context. I think the main figure here is Keith Tippett. I think Keith Tippett's piano is really important to the proceedings here. Apparently, Dunmall has played with some of these guys in some other groups, and I think he's played with Tippett on multiple occasions. Tippett, especially here, to me sounds very much in a Cecil Taylor bag. And what I mean by that is he plays the whole piano, by which I mean at least one cut here. He's definitely playing, he's plucking the piano strings from inside the, you know, I don't know what you call that, but I mean, that's all it could be.
The guts of the piano, yeah, whatever it's, yeah.
I like that. That's the official term. He's playing the guts of the piano.
That's right.
The
squishy inner organs.
The squishy insides. And he gets into Cecil Taylor kind of frenetic figures from time to time. He's always here kind of punctuating in the background. I didn't notice him soloing that much. This breaks into five parts. Sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't, when an album is just titled, you know, part one, part two, part three. This is, you know, five parts. He does get some significant soloing on part five, where they give the drummer some as well. And that is actually a more mellow a cut. But the more typical stuff here would be the longer cuts, part three and part four. Part three is really just drums and bass boiling, and you get sort of unison horns over that, with solos for the trumpet and the tenor throughout. And they're fine. It's good. But this was a little bit, I don't know, did you feel like you were listening to a Cecil Taylor unit at some point listening to this?
I'm not sure I was as attentive as I might have been to the piano playing, but it definitely, there were little moments of tonality.
Yes.
But then largely it was in that language. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I necessarily thought of him individually as a practitioner, but definitely of, you know, avant-garde, atonal, energy-focused music, which, you know, it's an interesting question. As I said, I don't know that, you know, one, obviously, as I've always, you know, it's just not, I'm okay with it, but it's not my favorite kind of music, period. But then also, you know, is this large ensemble, are you getting the most mileage out of it when you do that kind of music? Because at some point, does it matter if it's eight or two or a hundred? It's not the language that you feel like are getting the most mileage from having eight musicians in particular on a given gig. Now, there were moments where it gets quite tonal, but that's not a language it's committed to. And I think when you get past a certain point of atonality and energy, it's just like, I just feel like that's its own thing. I mean, that if you have a lot of ranging, unless it's pretty organically connected, and unless the energy sections are in some ways organized beyond just being eruptions, then it's almost like you forget, or they're just a second a separate part of the music that you, well, we had this moment where I was like, and everybody was playing a written out line and it was all, and then it's just like, and really that it's like it happened on a different planet. And then you left that planet and you went to a whole different planet, and it's kind of irrelevant to what happens afterwards. It's just this occurred, and then this other thing that's so unrelated to it occurred that it's kind of hard to connect them into any kind of whole. It's like there's this little joke about tonality, and then we're going to forget that, and we're going to explode. Yeah, I guess like I wasn't necessarily thinking of Cecil, good old Cecil, but I was definitely thinking of that idiom a lot. And I don't know, as I said, that, you know, there's some fine playing here. And I don't know that it had to be an octet per se. And I don't know that the bebop aspect of it, I guess I would have liked more of a thread running through it, even if the thread got pretty strained than I had, where I felt like it was bookends.
Yeah. You know, I did like this, and I think I think most of what you say is right. If you're going to have an octet, it almost feels like you do need through composition, or one begins to wonder why there are eight voices here. So just, you needed eight people in order to play. Sometimes if you're Henry Threadgill, you use eight people, but you don't use all eight all the time. And there are like forces you can draw upon, which still makes you wonder why you call it an octet. But in this case, since a lot of it is energy music, you wonder about that. There were enough slow passages, though, I thought, that were kind of through composed that I didn't, that was okay. There weren't many. Part four has a kind of unified open. That is sort of composed, and then pretty soon it turns into solos, and then it becomes really frenetic and out, especially the outro just becomes very out. There's some very fiery tenor soloing on that particular cut as well. So there are some moments where you're like, okay, yeah, I hear eight pieces, you know, I hear eight things happening at once, and the very deceptive opening cut, you know, which is less than a minute, you know, which sounds like, okay, this is going to be like very sped up, you know, ensemble playing. And then it turns out, nope, we're going out. So that was kind of interesting. Maybe that's the starburst. The bebop was the first 50 seconds and the starburst was everything. The starburst was everything else. Yeah, but I never heard of this guy. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. I'd like to hear more. This would be fun to hear more of.
Yeah, you know, there are so many musicians out there. And I guess to me, the alternate case would be, and I looked at this briefly, I've got a Duke Ellington octet recording I've had for years. I think he used to do a regular gig at the Rainbow Grill in Chicago. And somebody recorded one of these, and he traveled with a small group. And, you know, I've also got Basie octet recording somewhere. And there it's the opposite, where it's like all this is a shrunk down big band. I mean, you don't really feel like that going from 15 to 8, something special has occurred. It's just like the same fine soloist in both ensembles with stripped down versions of their old arrangements, right? It's not a reimagining of what you can do and maybe how you can benefit from having, you know, one horn to a choir instead of four, and the kind of transparencies that gives you, and the kind of, in a way, you know, subtleties you can add because there aren't so many voices overpowering, say, a really piquant harmony or something. It's just a smaller version of the group. So I thought, well, I love Ellington to death. I always love to talk about Ellington, but I don't see any point in discussing this octet because really it's just the Ellington band with fewer people. So, you know, what's there to say? And yeah, in a way, it's like you can go that direction, or you've got the super avant-garde group where maybe they play with tonality and arrangement for 5 minutes, but then the rest of it is just power blowing. It's like, well, you know, it's kind of the opposite thing. If you're really about energy and chaos, or, you know, not chaos, but just intuitive structures and a lot of personal expression, a lot of energy, then there's eight people there, but the octetness of it isn't very pronounced. Whereas with Gianluigi or with Rod, you know, you feel like they are taking that size ensemble and doing something distinctive with it. Just as, you know, Threadgill with his septet that he called a sextet, or David Murray, they're getting the absolute mileage out of this ensemble, right? It sounds right. And really, I don't want to hear. In fact, David Murray did a couple big band albums about that era, and I've just found them kind of disappointing. They just weren't as good. You know, he did not have the talent to make that many people interesting the way he did with eight. So yeah, it was neat. I mean, again, it's just fascinating to me. I'm looking for octets where you think of, I don't know, it's a little bit larger budget, maybe just a little more ambitious. And here are musicians who are obviously very accomplished from England. And I just never even heard of them, much less, you know their music. So it's kind of cool to dip into these completely unknown ensembles. I think the avant-garde leanings of both, while admirable, kind of, you know, it's like, well, did you need eight people, or is this scarier that way? I don't know, you know. So those are our octets. I did throw in a oddity that I think I downloaded illegally from somebody who boasted it many years ago. It was originally Japan only, came out here briefly in the States. I love me some funk. What do you think of Paul Jackson? Did you tiptoe through the ghetto with him? Black Octopus.
I love this to death. I think it's awesome. I got no complaints about this. Apart from the fact that it has nothing to do with today's theme.
Octopus.
Stop.
Octopus. Eight.
Stop it.
Octopus.
It's awesome. I enjoy the hell out of this. I don't know. I don't know who wouldn't enjoy this. If you don't like funk, then you're not going to like this, I guess. And you're a bad person. If you don't like hip shaking, rump shaking, exciting, vibrant, foot tapping music, then this is not for you. But if you have a soul, if you have a pulse, then I find it hard to think that anyone wouldn't enjoy this. The vocals are interesting. They're not brilliant, but they're interesting. They're consistently interesting.
No.
But my favorite song here has to be, without a doubt, T-Bolt. Why? Because it opens with some kick-ass triangle, and it keeps the triangle going for the whole fucking song. Man, that's cool. I like the shit out of that. And I guess that's Alphonse Mouzon on drums, because there's no percussionist listed here. It's just got this really trippy triangle figure, which opens it. And then the poor guy just has to do that for 7 minutes while, what's his name? Webster Laws? Whoever is playing organ here just tears it up. With some really, really fine guitar fills behind. And it's also kind of weird and spacey, headhunter style. It's just awesome. I mean, I just love that. But we've got Burners here. We've got Slow Jam Funk. Ironically, the song called Burning in the Heat of Your Love. Actually, a song called Burning in the Heat of Your Love shouldn't be a burner, and this one isn't. This is like a slow jam funk, and toward the middle, it turns into disco, which I take it is if you're with your significant other enjoying a moment of passion, basically Paul Jackson and the band are telling you, pick up the pace.
Exactly.
You know, about halfway through, they're like, okay, you know, it's an 8-minute song, and halfway through, they're like, all right, we're going disco now, double time. I love the whole goddamn thing. I think it's awesome. I also love the incredibly bizarre ending song. Bow tie dress, which is weird vocals over extremely treated keyboards and nothing else. I don't even know what that song is about.
And so that's even, so it's an expanded version. So when it comes out in Japan in 78, it's just, it ends with Tiptoe Through the Ghetto. It's like a 5-track album. And then when it's re-released in the States many years later, they add these other even stranger tunes. So the very opening tune is also weird, right? It's kind of very spacey. I mean, Herbie Hancock's on a track or two. We got Benny Maupin here. So there are some old alums of the Headhunters era, and Benny at least is back in the era of his earlier group on Warner Brothers. It's much spacier and just stranger than the Headhunters. So that it's very odd because that is so uncharacteristic of the rest of the album, which is very funky, and that first tune is kind of out and very trippy, and then, you know, it gets much more down the middle, and where you learn about their 8 ways of love. He's as a vocalist, he's
energetic, committed, and limited. I think those are all adjectives you want to use.
And limited, yes, absolutely.
Those are all the appropriate adjectives.
He's adequate to the needs of the funk. Yes, he honors the funk, but he is not going to scare Mel Torme or Pavarotti.
He's a lot of fun, and this is a lot of fun. I mean, it's just a good time. I don't know how anyone could dislike – I really don't know how you listen to – unless you just hate funk. I mean, are there such people? Maybe there are. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's certainly – you know, we grew up in the 70s. So
right, I suppose. Yeah.
And I just – I think for a lot of people, it's this alien thing, and I don't know if there's ever been a funk, you know, there's been ironic re-celebrations of disco and everything. I don't feel like funk has ever had a comeback quite that way. I guess it's always been with us in our hearts, but have trendy hipsters ever decided that funk was great again? I don't know.
Well, if they haven't, they should, because by God, I could use a lot more of this in my life, frankly. It's a blast. I love the hell out of this album. It is not something you have to think about. It is just, you listen to it, and that's the whole, like, it is what it is. It's very, very straightforward and clear to me what this is about, what it's doing. It's not music you have to process intellectually at all.
No, there's no hidden agenda, right?
Yeah, it's just good music. I don't know, I really like this.
Play it backwards. It's like sour cream is delicious. Yeah.
Yeah. I bitched and moaned at the beginning, but I really have no complaints. I think this is awesome. I really enjoyed it. So.
Well, it's easygoing stuff. It's a palate cleanser. And it's a fun little oddity that a lot of people may not have heard of. I mean, you know, Jackson's not a big name. He was a fine bass player, but as a leading man, as a leader, not well-known entity. And yeah, Japan just could not get enough Herbie Hancocking. Because I remember when I got Herbie Hancock's Columbia recordings, which, you know, I got a lot of pleasure out of. You know, there's just a period where it seems like half of everything released was Japan only. It was just much more prolific over there than it was in the States. And for whatever reason, they've got a special place. And they've always, you know, there've been serious jazz fans and serious funk fans. You know, their love of American music doesn't stop in the 50s and 60s. And in fact, I've got a couple kind of cool dubs off the internet of people releasing LPs that are kind of Japanese musicians doing, you know, the kind of the Herbie Hancock Headhunters thing, as opposed to imitating, you know, Blue Notes of the classic era. And they tend to be very good at least, you know, the ones that I've got. I presumably you don't upload terrible examples of it to the internet, but so yes, it's interesting, record industry over there. I mean, they're making recordings that other people were not bothering to do. All right. Well, we made it through our pottery and copper anniversary. Hooray for bronze. That was a bronze and pottery.
You're okay.
I it's very odd. They just make shit up till you get to 10th. I don't know. It's like, what is this crap? Did you have any pot matters?
Have you been listening to the Nilsons? What do you think of them?
I've been, you know, in and out, and the one you haven't sent me yet is Knilson with a K, right? There's that the very last. I didn't find that one. Maybe it got lost somewhere.
Bastard!
I'm curious to hear it because that's the one I have not heard. So, and I have, you know, I've just dipped into them. I think what I'd say is this: is that I know you hate my Beach Boys fixation, but in certain ways there are parallels, in that.
Oh yeah.
They both have these moments. I mean, the Beach Boys, much more influential and successful band, right there, you know. But there's a period where things get very strange. And they're both kind of in this nether realm between pop and rock, right? I mean, the Beach Boys, they listen to Chuck Berry, but they also have an awful lot of antecedents of easy listening and old harmony groups and jazz. You know, they're not firmly in the rock camp. They don't have any blues in their bones at all. Nilsson's very much that way.
Yep.
And then when he shoots his voice out, he's still a better singer than the great ravaged voices of the burnt out early 70s, like Dennis Wilson, Brian Wilson, Chris Bell, Neil Young, where they're all just kind of fucking ravaged. I mean, I was thinking, how awful is this going to be? And it's like, yeah, well, he sounds kind of rough on some of these later records, but he's still in decent shape, you know?
By comparison, you know, it's funny you mentioned Chris Bell, because I just was listening to something by him. The thing that the last three discs in that collection are just studio oddities that RCA had. Nilsson went on for like another 15 years. So this is just RCA.
Right.
The last one has his piano demo of Without You. And it's almost too painful to listen to because he's very young, right? So this is, you know, just when he was in perfect voice, and it's just him. It's his demo on piano of that song. And he sings it like he bleeds all over the fucking keyboards. He sings, he fucking tears his throat out singing this song. And you know, it's a song famous for its soaring multi-tracked harmony of his voice. I think the demo is better. Like the demo is actually more emotionally painful to listen to. Because he's just laying it all out. Like he's holding nothing back. It is as naked as late Bill Evans on piano. It's just like, oh my God, dude, close that vein up, you know?
Right, and he did, because so much of it is fucking around and humorous after that.
I know.
He really hit a wall, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I can't go here anymore. I can't do this. That demo is, I think it's better than the song as recorded, because it's just him in a room with the piano, and he's like, he can hit all the notes. I mean, he's young, his voice is perfect, but he's literally screaming the first chorus, and it brings tears to your eyes, because you're like, this is a soul in torment. Like, this is what a soul in torment sounds like. And he's young and his voice is perfect, and he's belting it like he's, you know, a gospel singer in a church in the deep South. Like, he's just, it's amazing. It's uncanny. I it may be the favorite thing I've heard by him of all.
Well, I'll have to listen to that. I mean, because I'm, you know, one of my all-time favorites Beach Boys recordings is God Only Knows a Live Rehearsal. And it's the same kind of deal. It's not quite so hard on sleeve, but it's just them without the fancy production. And you can just tell they're kind of like getting into the magic of that song in a way that even, you know, the well-known original doesn't quite capture. There's something kind of naked about it. So I'll have to listen to those. I'm so far from getting through the whole thing yet that I'm still just kind of sampling the albums, but I will dig deeper, I promise.
Oh, he is well worth the trip. That was a great gift. And there's a lot of fluff on the later albums, but he's never, you know, his sense of humor is so good. And he writes some truly filthy songs. You know, he's got this one about Sit on My Face. And, you know, you're just like, really, yeah, dude? I mean, really? Come on. But he's always interesting. And at his best, you know, he's this weird mixture of, you know, Lennon McCartney, Brill Building with like the voice of an angel. He's almost too perfect a songwriter. And, you know, it makes sense. It almost makes sense that he crashed and burned the way he did, because he was like too many gifts. Like he was lavished with too many gifts, and maybe fame or, you know, drugs and all that was just too much for him. A lot of Christmas music in the rotation, but I will tell you, you know, years ago I hooked you up with Sinatra's London, that 3-disc set.
Oh, yeah.
And I was listening again today to one of the discs, and I think it's the second disc. It has a live BBC outing for 7 minutes or so, and he's in fine voice for that. But it's the rehearsals that are fascinating. You can hear, I mean, supposedly Sinatra arrived in London after a long tour, and he had a number of dates in Britain. But he was going to do some, he recorded an album, which was later released in the States, Great Hits from Great Britain. That's what the London 3-CD set repackages. And he's not in good voice. He's still very close to his prime, but he's shot from touring. You can hear it. And it's just fascinating to hear. The disc two is all him working with the producer, the strings arranger. I think a guy, I forget his first name, his last name, I think is Foreman. Might be Robin Foreman. And I think he's very good. I think the string arrangements are fantastic. And they get some incredible solos from like the trombone player and from some of the other players in this group. But Sinatra's voice is like he's had too many nights out drinking and smoking on tour. And his voice, you can hear it starting to fray. And it's just dead fascinating listening to a man try and make his way through, you know, a song like The Very Thought of You, which they take at a glacial pace. And The Very Thought of You is deceptively difficult. And it just gives me a new appreciation for Sinatra at his best, when he was in absolute control all the time. This is a guy coming off a tour in a studio trying to, you know, coax his voice. You know, the guy, he should have taken like a 3-month break and drank lemon juice or something, you know. I mean, he's The Very Thought of You is taken at such a slow pace, and it begins at a fairly low point in his range. And man, he can barely keep the fabric of his voice together. And it's like heroic listening to him do take after fucking take, you know, and sometimes he'll cough or, you know, have to clear his throat. And you're just like, dude, I mean, it just gives me a new appreciation for, you know, those Capitol sessions, which were God's gift to music. This is a guy who's just past his prime. And his voice is starting to fray. And this is what it sounds like when you have to fight for control in the recording studio. it's really cool. It's interesting to listen to. So.
Cool.
How about you?
Yeah, not a lot. I've at some point after Christmas is done, Joyce always has me get my own presents. So she's like, get some records. So one of the things that was on sale, apparently they got too many in the warehouse. I now have the complete Police on LP, which is what nobody needs. So I'll be listening to the Police all over again. Nice Abbey Road half speed mastered pressings, because Amazon was unloading them at fire sale prices. But that's going to happen a little bit later. We'll see. I think mainly I'm just going to listen to the drumming. I think that's what I've learned about the Police, is that really it's all about Stuart Copeland. And then I picked up another one of these advertised things. Was this Italian prog rock group called Deus Ex Machina. We'll be right back. It's a long record. I listened to it, and it's sung either in Italian or I think I read somewhere Latin. And of course, since it's Prague, it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, if John Anderson was singing Latin the whole time, would it have mattered? I don't think so. It's very much in that, you know, highly technical, multiple time signatures, driving. There's a violin, so that's a little distinctive. It's like an album of studio stuff and then an album of live stuff. And I think I got somewhere into the middle of the live stuff at work, and I realized I needed a break. So I want to go back to it. It's pretty good, but it's exhausting. So anyway, there's an Italian prog group that I didn't know about before, and much more ambitious than Goblin. But I don't, this is this weird, you know, along with the Italian jazz tradition, there's this kind of proggy tradition over there.
There is.
You know, both in soundtrack music and just in general. And it's always got this flavor of, you know, it's similar, but just slightly different because it's coming from a different cultural place. And, you know, this was certainly entertaining. It's just any kind of prog, it can only take so much in a given day. And then I need some Blue Note or something to calm down. So I'll report back on that when I've heard the rest of it. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 208 and our 8th season. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. You can drop me a line at All About Jazz or look us up on Facebook. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Mixcloud, from Stitcher, and it can be streamed at All About Jazz. Tune in next time for a 0.5 episode while we take a little break over the holidays and prepare ourselves for Season 9. I'm going to be talking about Record Store Day releases by Don Cherry, Marion Brown, Jimmy Giuffre, and Jazz Sabbath. We're hoping to get some pretty interesting interviews this year. I'm also hoping we can do a episode on Blue Note releases of last year that we missed. And of course, we'll be looking at brand new releases and historical releases all season long. Until next time, take care.